From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, looking to negotiate a political solution with the Syrian regime. A warning that the U.S. strategy in Syria is not working. We hear from a survivor of the Vanuatu cyclone and a critique of Iran's new internet search engine.
One would have to think that, you know, it's probably likely that use is somehow also being used to track what people are doing and what they're searching for.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. As the Syrian conflict enters its fifth year, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says it is time to reignite a diplomatic outcome to a conflict that has killed more than 200,000 people and displaced millions. VOA's Victor Beatty reports Secretary Kerry says an effort is underway to convince President Bashar al-Assad to change his calculation and enter into negotiations.
Speaking Sunday on the CBS program Face the Nation from Egypt, where he took part in an investment conference, Secretary of State Kerry said it's time to restart negotiations to end the Syrian civil war.
We are working very hard with other interested parties to see if we can reignite a diplomatic outcome. Why? Because everybody agrees there is no military solution. There is only a political solution. But to get the Assad regime to negotiate, we're going to have to make it clear to him that there is a determination by everybody to seek that political outcome and change his calculation about negotiating. That's underway right now. And I am convinced that with the efforts of our allies and others, there will be increased pressure on Assad.
Kerry says the United States has always been willing to negotiate in the context of the Geneva One process, a reference to the 2012 talks that led to the Geneva Communique, a document outlining a six-point plan to stop the violence and create a transitional governing body. That was rejected by the Syrian government. A subsequent Geneva II meeting in 2014 ended in an impasse. The latest effort at negotiations was sponsored by Russia in January, but the main opposition Syrian National Coalition refused to attend. Asked if he is prepared to negotiate with the Syrian leader, Kerry said, "We have to negotiate with the regime." Media reports suggested he was referring to Mr. Assad, but a U.S. State Department spokeswoman later issued a statement saying U.S. policy has not changed, adding there is no future for a brutal dictator like Assad in Syria. Further, she said, by necessity, there has always been a need for representatives of the Assad regime to be a part of the peace process. Middle East analyst Ian Lustig of the University of Pennsylvania believes the warring factions may be closer now than ever to reach a political settlement.
Many of the options that people fought for and imagined that negotiations could work in relation to are now not being entertained. For example, the idea that Assad will simply leave of his own accord with a graceful set of negotiations to allow him to do so, nobody is imagining that anymore. So some things have been accomplished in the sense that some quote-unquote solutions seem to be impossible now. What I don't think we're closer to is a negotiating process that would lead to a re-establishment of the Syrian state united across the territory that has been traditionally governed by Damascus.
Analyst Jonathan Edelman of the University of Denver says the Kurdish, Sunni, and Shia factions emerging from the conflict reflect a rejection of the 1916 Sykes-Picot Agreement, defining British and French spheres of influence in the former Ottoman Empire.
This is a very much possibly a model for what's likely to happen in Iraq, the division of a country into its Sunni, its Shiite, and its Kurdish parts. And going back 90, 100 years to the Sykes-Picot Treaty during World War I, this is when the colonial powers just decided where the borders were. And in a very horrible, horrible way, these people are trying to decide that they really don't want to be a part of this Syria, except for the Alawites and some of the Christians. They support overwhelmingly Bashar Assad, but they're not the majority of the population.
Friday, Deputy U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told representatives of the Syrian opposition and members of the Syrian American diaspora the United States remains committed to a genuine political solution to end the war and restore the nation. Blinken said the conflict has pushed 80% of the population below the poverty line. Life expectancy has been cut by 20 years to 55, and nearly half of Syria's pre-war population has been displaced. The Deputy Secretary of State said the Obama administration is asking Congress for another $70 million in foreign assistance to the moderate Syrian opposition, bringing to nearly $400 million U.S. support since the conflict began. He said the United States will offer additional humanitarian assistance to displaced Syrians during a forthcoming Kuwait Donors Conference. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Syria Robert Ford is warning that the current U.S. strategy in Syria is not working. Ford, who served in Damascus from 2010 until last year, says coalition airstrikes against the militant group that calls itself the Islamic State have done little to diminish the militant strategic depth in Syria or Iraq. Moreover, he says, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's forces have responded to Washington's actions by adopting a strategy of fighting against the moderate Syrian opposition and leaving the ISIS terrorists alone. Ambassador Ford spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy.
The United States has not been able to find a way to achieve a political negotiation for a political deal in Syria, and the United States has not yet been able to reduce the power of Daesh in a significant way in Syria yet. So both of the key issues for the United States, we have not yet been successful.
So what went wrong and what can be fixed in the U.S. strategy toward the Syrian crisis?
First, the Americans must decide, what do they want to do? Do the Americans want only to contain the Islamic State in Iraq, or do the Americans also want to contain and remove Islamic State Daesh from Syria? If they want to remove Daesh from Syria, then the Americans must do much more. Number one, to help Syrian moderate opposition, and number two, the Americans must do more working with Syrian opposition to put pressure on Bashar al-Assad, because Bashar al-Assad is the biggest friend of Daesh.
If you were to recommend conditions for considerable amount of U.S. aid to Syrian opposition to avoid the fragmentation and to secure its success, what would be these conditions?
Number one, the countries that give material assistance to the Syrian armed opposition must all agree with the Syrian opposition about a unified command structure so that all of the assistance from all of the countries, no exceptions, goes to that unified command, and the unified command can then issue instructions, issue military orders to the fighting groups about what to do. Then it will be possible to increase pressure on Assad forces and increase pressure on jihadi forces. At the same time, the amount of assistance must be increased a great deal, significantly. But in return, the Syrian opposition must accept that there must be a political negotiation, and they must be ready to negotiate with Assad. Assad must be the partner that they negotiate with. And in addition, the Syrian opposition needs to understand the fears, needs to understand the worries of the communities in Syria that still support Assad, and they need to make gestures to help those communities supporting Assad, to help those communities reduce their fears, which will make a political solution easier.
But the United States insists that Assad should go.
The United States says that Assad has no legitimacy and that it is better for him to step down, but the United States always said that it is up to Syrians to negotiate. The Americans will not negotiate a political solution in Syria. Syrians have to do that job.
Geneva 1, Geneva 2, Moscow 1 failed to launch a successful negotiation for Syrian unity government.
Mm-hmm.
What's necessary to launch a successful one?
Well, the successful negotiation will be the one that has representatives from the people fighting on both sides, on the government side and on the opposition side, because in the end, it is the men with guns who must agree to stop using their guns.
Would the Obama administration consider a revision of its policy towards Syria?
Right now, the Obama administration's number one priority is the Islamic State in Iraq. And I cannot imagine that this administration will change its position until it feels it has been successful in Iraq.
But do you see a regional role in helping the United States addressing the Syrian crisis?
Absolutely. The United States cannot change the situation in Syria by itself. It will need help from friendly nations like Turkey and Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates and Qatar and countries in Europe. But those countries, I think, are waiting for the Americans to decide what do the Americans want. Is it only to fight Islamic State in Iraq, or is it also to begin to try to find a solution in Syria?
Former U.S. Ambassador to Syria, Robert Ford. People on the Republic of Vanuatu in the South Pacific are attempting to recover from a devastating cyclone and storm surge that left behind widespread destruction. Initial reports indicate at least 8 people dead and as many as 30 others injured. Thousands are homeless. Cyclone Pam roared ashore late Friday with winds as high as 340 kilometers an hour, leaving the impoverished nation of less than 267,000 people homeless, hungry, thirsty, and open to disease. Derek Bryan heads the Pacific Institute of Public Policy in the capital city.
Extraordinary scenes of devastation of houses that have been flattened, ranging from some of the tin shack houses in the settlements, which we all expected to be flattened. Some of them survived. And then some of the sturdy concrete houses that some of them have been blown away. No one really got spared from this. The biggest thing that you notice is just all the vegetation is gone. And that's going to be the most frightening thing, because most people here rely on their garden for food. So all the fruit trees are gone. All the crops have been clearly destroyed. So our biggest issue in the coming weeks and months is going to be food. At the moment, everyone is in triage mode in terms of just trying to patch things up and make sure that everyone's safe. People are just rallying together in terms of housing, people who don't have anywhere to sleep.
We asked about recovery efforts.
The emergency services have supported one of the private medical emergency services. You know, they cleared the airport and the roads, the hospital. A lot of the hospital was damaged. Everyone else is out there clearing roads to make sure that people can move around, trying to piece together shelter and a lot of chainsaw activity, just clearing the debris away.
Vanuatu is an archipelago of some 80 islands.
I'm currently on Afate, which is where the capital, Port Vila, is located. The communications to the outer islands. Vanuatu's got 86 islands, a great deal of those inhabited, and about 6 major population centres outside of Port Vila. All the communications are down, so flights have been going around over the last 24 hours doing reconnaissance missions and, I think, landing where they can. The first response is to deal with casualties and to treat people who've been injured, to do an assessment and work out how to get the food stocks out of the islands, because, you know, at least here in Port Vila, the supermarkets are reopened, so people are going in and buying up on the essentials, rice, water, tinned food. In many of the outer islands, that option is not available. People rely on their gardens for food, and that is not available either. So this is a major emergency.
We asked Derek how he sheltered from the storm.
We're in a house, a concrete house, which was well boarded up and prepared for. We had about 20 people downstairs in a very secure basement-type bunker, and then we had 9 people upstairs in the main part of the house. We lost large plate glass windows when it really kicked off, and we all took refuge in the bathroom, 9 people with mattresses piled to try and protect us from flying debris. I mean, I've been told it was gusting up to 340 kilometres an hour.
He says they did have advance notice of the storm it was coming.
This was a very slow-moving cyclone. It was actually a week out that it was headed in our direction, moving very slowly and tracking for us, and predicted to be a Category 5. But, you know, I've got to say, there are many people out there who did everything by the book in terms of preparation, and they locked everything. And there are other people who perhaps didn't do everything by the book and didn't suffer as badly. So this one was really hit and miss. You know, it was just where you were, your particular shelter was located, and if you were in one of those pockets where the gusts were just intense, it took everything out.
Relief flights have already begun arriving in Vanuatu with tarpaulins, generators, water containers, medical supplies, and construction tools. Aid workers say they also need food, clean water, temporary toilets, and hygiene kits. A new internet search engine has been unveiled in Iran, and it's being pushed by government officials as the best way for Iranians to search the web. Called Yooze, the search engine works in many of the same ways as more popular search engines such as Google, Bing, or Yahoo, with one major difference. It is designed to exclusively search Persian language websites and blogs based in Iran. But even before it was officially launched, cybersecurity and internet freedom activists have been cautioning people from using Yooze. Our cyber correspondent, Doug Bernard, joins us now. Doug, what's this all about?
Well, you know, in the end, I really think it's about controlling access to information on the web. The government of Iran has long filtered the web. They employ a very strict censorship regime, and this just may be the next step. So let's take a look at what it actually is. Yooze, which is an interesting name, that actually means cheetah in Persian, and the government authorities chose that word because they're billing Yooze as being a very fast way to search for Persian language material that's online. They say that it's already crawled a billion web pages, and they hope to up that to several billion in the future. That's how a search engine works, by cataloging all those pages that it crawls. And authorities behind you say it's more secure than Western-based search engines such as Bing or Yahoo. And they also say that it will make it easier for Iranians to find information about Iran from Persian language sources.
So just how debatable are those claims?
Well, first, it does not appear to be more secure than Google or Bing or Yahoo. In fact, a very quick analysis that we conducted, this was just a cursory analysis, found that the Yooze site is actually missing its security certificate. That's like that little digital insurance policy that confirms you're actually at the site that says it is and that it's handling your information securely and properly. So that's a very easy and early red flag that should caution people from using Yooze. And we did test the engine, actually. I've been playing around with it a little bit. To its credit, it is speedy. But we also found that it's very limited in terms of the hits that it delivers back for you. So if you go searching, we tried this across a wide variety of search terms, some controversial, some very non-controversial. Those cases where we searched for controversial subjects touching on politics or religion, that kind of thing, the results were very heavily filtered. And remember, we were conducting these tests from here in the U.S., so you have to imagine they're even more heavily filtered in Iran as well.
Well, so why would they go to all this trouble of creating an entirely new search engine that filters out unapproved content when they could just censor the results right off Google or Yahoo, couldn't they?
Well, you know, there are several reasons, and I'm intuiting here because the government didn't really say. But the first might just be appearances. So now if a site looks legitimate, if a search engine looks like it's giving you everything that you want, you might not know any different that your web search results are being heavily censored. So if you can direct people to a site that automatically, as part of its structure, censors out all kinds of information that the government finds objectionable, that's actually easier for the government than having to go and censor or filter out, you know, thousands upon thousands of websites that are constantly shifting. Remember, because everybody's kind of constantly moving around trying to get information into Iran. At the second level, and this is a more broad perspective, might be linked to Iran's efforts to build what they call the halal internet. Basically, what that would be is a intranet. It would build a permanent wall from Iranian cyberspace, blocking it off from the rest of the global internet, and create its own national, its own unique national little intranet. Now, most experts I've actually spoken with say they don't believe such a thing can even be done. And there is no precedent yet in history for any nation that once it's connected to the global internet is in any way able to sever that connection. So that's really debatable. But I think what's happening here is Iran is building what I would just call a filter net. This is something that we've seen in China. Rather than disconnecting from the internet, what they're doing is constructing a whole series of filters to mediate what gets in and what goes out from the country. And it's possible that use might just be yet another step in building that filter net. But either way, I guess my end counsel would be that if anyone is interested in really looking at the totality of what is out there on the internet, don't use.
Okay, Doug, let me ask you one quick question. What seems a little scary to me about this is that the people who are going on use, they can track where they go and what they try to do.
That's very possible as well. We didn't get into the forensic analysis that deep, but that has to be a concern, I think, that the government in unveiling this and really putting their weight behind it and encouraging people to use it, given the fact that they so closely surveil their citizens' online activities, one would have to think that it's probably likely that use is somehow also being used to track what people are doing and what they're searching for.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
That's VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard right here in our Washington studios. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. We invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey reporting to you from Washington.
This is Today in History. In 1751, U.S. President James Madison was born. Madison is known as the father of the U.S. Constitution. On this day in 1802, the U.S. Congress founded the U.S. Military Academy, located at West Point, New York. The U.S. Military Academy is simply known as West Point. On this day in 1850, The Scarlet Letter, Nathaniel Hawthorne's novel about spiritual and moral issues set in 17th century America, was first published. In 1916, two regiments under the command of John J. Pershing crossed the U.S.-Mexico border to join the hunt for the notorious Mexican border raider Pancho Villa. In 1935, German dictator Adolf Hitler ordered the rearmament of his country in violation of the Treaty of Versailles that ended World War I. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Tunisia has undergone a historic transition from dictatorship to democracy. But this political shift is only part of what is needed, said U.S. Secretary of Commerce Penny Pritzker. The next step, economic reform, is essential if the revolution is to fulfill the ambitions of the Tunisian people. While the Tunisian government has taken some important first steps, more reforms are necessary to encourage investment and to create an environment for widespread job creation. One of these areas includes Tunisia's investment code. It needs to be streamlined and simplified. Clarifying the investment code will incentivize business formation and competition and send a signal to investors that Tunisia is open for business. Tunisia's banking system is burdened by too many non-performing loans. Bank reform is necessary to support the creation of new viable businesses, and a bankruptcy law that protects risk takers and permits failure must be part of that reform. Another area in need of change is Tunisia's current tax and customs system, which remains unpredictable, inefficient, and too discretionary. Tunisia needs a transparent, reliable, and modern tax structure with equitable tax brackets that incorporate the informal economy into the broader market. Finally, Tunisia would benefit from a strong public-private partnership law that increases transparency and predictability for domestic and foreign firms that want to invest in the country. In order to jumpstart Tunisia's economic development, the U.S. has announced a series of new programs. Among them is the Department of Commerce-supported public-private partnership called the Regional Investments to Support Entrepreneurship, or RISE. This new platform is a partnership between the Department of Commerce and Microsoft, Hewlett-Packard, Cisco, Pfizer, and Medtronic to promote trade and investment between the U.S. and Tunisia, increase market access, and strengthen commercial rule of law. The State Department has also just launched a partnership with the Detroit-based organization, Detroit Soup, a pioneering crowdfunding model that will help start up Tunisian social entrepreneurs and creative businesses through a competition based on democratic voting that distributes capital raised from private participants for the best ideas. The United States, said Secretary Pritzker, will stand by Tunisia as it continues to fulfill the promises of its revolution. A government that adheres to the voices of Tunisia's citizens, an economy that advances opportunity for Tunisia's families, and the freedom for all to speak out and determine their destiny.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.